He shut down his computer and looked at Webb. Any more questions? The admiration was clear on Webb's features. Okay, you convinced me. You know computers. Yeah, I bust my ass in school, finally get a job that doesn't require me to wear a hairnet, and the fine folks at social services tell us we make too much damn money and we got to leave our home we've been at for the last 5 years. System sucks. No, people who have never been on it think the system sucks. For people on it, we wouldn't have had any place to live without it. But it still ticks me off that I'm making a little more than damn Burger King pays and we get kicked out. It's not like my employer dropped any stock options on somebody like me. Look, it's still a start, Jerome, and better than the alternative around here, you know that. I'm gonna keep moving up. Work my ass off, and then we are out of here, and we're never looking back. You and your grandmother? She took me in when my mama died. Brain tumor and no health insurance. That ain't a real good combo. My daddy bit it on a 45 he stuck in his own mouth when he was high on something. You damn right I'll take care of her, just like she took care of me. And Kevin? I take care of Kevin, too. He glowered at Webb. If you people can find him. We're trying. I know a little about his family, his relation to Francis. He's Kevin's father, so what? A little more than that. I've met Francis up close, too close, actually. Webb pointed out the remnants of his assorted facial injuries inflicted by the man. Jerome looked at him curiously. You lucky that's all he done to you. Yeah, I'm getting that feeling. He told me how Kevin came into this world, with his mother and all. Stepmother. What? She was Francis's stepmother, strung out most of the time. Don't know what happened to his real mama. Webb let out a relieved breath. It wasn't incest. He glanced at Claire, who said, So they're actually not brothers. They're father and son. Does Kevin know that? I never told him. But he thinks Francis is his brother. Is that how Francis wanted it? Asked Claire, while Webb watched her closely. What Francis wants, he gets. That answer enough for you? Why would Francis want Kevin to believe they were brothers? Maybe he didn't want Kevin to know he was screwing his stepmom and Kevin's mom. Her name was Roxy. She was into drugs and all that, but she was good to Kevin before she died. How did Kevin get shot? Asked Webb. He was with Francis, got caught in some gang shootout. Francis brought him here, only time I ever seen that man cry. I took him to the hospital myself, 'cause cops just arrest his ass if Francis took him. Kevin never cried, not one time, and bleeding like a son of a bitch. But he's never been the same since. Other kids tease him, call him a retard. Kids can be cruel, and then they grow up and get even more cruel. They're just a lot more subtle about it, commented Claire. Kevin ain't stupid, smart as a whip. And he can draw, man. Draw like you can't believe. Claire looked interested. Care to show me? Jerome checked his watch. I can't be late for work, and I gotta take the bus. To your big cookie shop? Asked Webb. For the very first time, Jerome and Webb exchanged a smile. I tell you what, Jerome, you show us Kevin's stuff and talk to us a little bit more, and I'll personally drive you to work in one bitching machine that'll have all your friends envious as hell. How about that? Jerome led them upstairs and down a short hallway that ended with a very small room. When Jerome turned on the light, Webb and Claire looked around in amazement. Every inch of the walls and even the ceiling was covered with drawings on paper, some in charcoal, others in colored pencil, and still others in pen and ink. And on a small table next to a mattress on the floor were stacks of sketchbooks. Claire picked up one and started going through it, while Webb continued to gaze at the drawings on the wall. Some of them were things Webb could recognize, landscapes and people. Jerome and his grandmother were reproduced in amazing detail. Other drawings were abstract in content, and Webb couldn't make sense of them. Claire looked up from the sketchbook, and her gaze swept around the room before focusing on Jerome. "I know a little something about art, Jerome, because my daughter is majoring in art history. Kevin has serious talent." Jerome looked to Webb like the proud father. "Kevin says that how he sees things sometimes. Just drawing what I'm seeing, he tells me." Webb looked at the art supplies and sketchbooks piled on the table. There was also a small easel in the corner with a blank canvas on it. "All this stuff costs money. Francis contributing?" "I buy Kevin his art stuff. He gets Kevin other stuff, clothes, shoes, basic things." "He offered to ever help you and your grandmother?" "He offered, but we ain't taking that money. We know where it comes from. Kevin's another matter. It's his daddy. Father's got a right to provide for his son." "Daddy come around much?" Jerome shrugged. "When he wants to." "You think he might be the one who has Kevin? Give it to me straight." Jerome shook his head. "As much as I don't like Francis, if you ask me, he'd cut off his own head before he'd let anything happen to that boy. I mean, he'll kill you so much as look at you. But around Kevin, he was gentle. A gentle giant, I guess you could say. He didn't want Kevin living with him because he knew it'd be too dangerous." "I imagine that was a big sacrifice for Francis, giving up something that he loved so much. But that's the true test of love, really, sacrifice," said Webb. "Well, man changes where he sleeps all the time 'cause people looking to kill him. Hell of a way to live. But he had people watching Kevin, making sure nobody got to Francis by going after him. It ain't like everybody knew of the connection, but he wasn't taking any chances." "You seen him since Kevin disappeared?" asked Webb. Jerome stepped back on that one and put his hands in his pockets, and Webb instantly sensed the wall going back up. "I'm not looking to get you in trouble, Jerome. Just tell me straight, and I promise you it won't go any further. You're doing really well. Keep your string going." Jerome seemed to think about this, one hand playing with his tie, as though wondering what the thing was doing around his neck. "The night Kevin didn't come home, it was late, maybe 3 a.m. I'd just got home from work and Granny was up and all a mess. She told me Kevin was missing. I was upstairs changing and getting ready to go looking for Kevin and wondering whether we should call the cops. I hear my granny downstairs talking to somebody. Or he was talking, yelling, that is, at her. It was Francis. He was mad like I ain't heard him mad ever before." He paused and looked for a moment like he might bolt again. "He was looking for Kevin, too. Was sure Granny had him hid somewhere. At least maybe he was hoping that was it. The way he was talking, I thought he'd be going after Granny. I almost come down the stairs. Now, I ain't no coward, and I ain't stupid either. Hell, that man probably take only a second to kill me, but it ain't like I'm letting him or anybody come in here and hurt her without trying to do something about it. You understand me?"
"I do, Jerome."
"Francis, he finally calmed down. He was getting it that Kevin wasn't here. So he left. Last time we've seen him. That's the truth."
"I appreciate you telling me. I guess it's probably hard to trust people right now."
Jerome looked Webb up and down. "You saved Kevin's life. That's worth something."
Webb looked at him warily.
"I read the papers, Mr. Webb London, hostage rescue team. Kevin be dead wasn't for you. Maybe that's why Francis didn't bust your skull."
"Hadn't really thought about it that way."
Webb looked at the stack of sketchbooks again. "The other agents who came here, did you tell them any of this?" "They didn't really ask."
"How about Kevin's room? They search up here?"
"Couple of them looked around, didn't take very long."
Webb looked at Claire. They seemed to read each other's thoughts. She said, "Do you mind if I borrow those sketchbooks? I'd like to show them to my daughter."
Jerome looked at the books and then at Webb. "You gotta promise to bring them back. That's Kevin's whole life right there," he said.
"I promise.
I promise I'll do everything I can to bring Kevin back, too. He gathered up the sketchbooks and then put a hand on Jerome's shoulder. Now it's time to get you to work. You'll find my chauffeuring fees are very reasonable. As they walked downstairs, Webb had one more question. Kevin was in that alley alone in the middle of the night. Did he do that a lot? Jerome looked away and said nothing. Come on, Jerome. Don't get tongue-tied on me now.
Hell, Kevin wanted to help us out. You know, make some money and we get out of this place. It bothered him that he never could do much like that. He was just a kid, but he thought like a grown-up on some things.
I guess a particular environment might do that for you.
Well, Kevin, he'd be out on the street sometimes. Granny too old to keep up with him. I don't know who he was hanging with, and whenever I caught him out there, I brought his butt home. But maybe he might be trying to make a little cash on the side. And around here, you can get that money, no matter how young you are. You hear me?
They dropped Jerome off at work and headed back to Claire's house.
By the way, you handled yourself like a pro back there, he said.
I guess it's more mental than physical, and that's my jurisdiction. She glanced at Webb. You know, you were pretty rough on Jerome.
It's probably because I've seen a million guys just like him in my life.
Stereotyping is dangerous, Webb, not to mention unfair to the person being categorized. The fact is, you can only know one Jerome at a time. And I could tell this Jerome busted your preconception all apart.
He did, admitted Webb. I guess when you've been doing my kind of work for so long, it's easier to lump folks together.
Like fathers?
Webb didn't answer that one.
Claire said, It is sad about Francis and Kevin. From what Jerome said, he must love his son very much, and to have to lead such a life.
I don't doubt the big guy loves Kevin either, but I've seen that same big guy kill a man in cold blood right in front of him, and he's also cleaned my clock twice, so my sympathy has its limits, said Webb very firmly.
One's environment does tend to dictate one's choices, Webb.
I can accept a little of that argument, but I've seen too many guys from even worse backgrounds make it just fine.
Including maybe yourself?
He ignored her question and instead said, I figure you pack some things and we find you a safe house with some agents there to make sure those folks don't come back.
I'm not so sure that's a good idea.
I want you to be safe.
I want to be safe, too. Trust me, I have no death wish. But if you're right, and that person was just pretending to be Francis, to scare me and throw suspicion on him, I'm probably not in any real danger.
Probably is right. That's only one theory, Claire, and it might be the wrong one.
I think if my routine remains the same, they have no reason to think I'm a threat. And I have something I really need to work on.
What?
She glanced over at him, and Webb had never seen her look so troubled. I'm thinking about a very brave man going into an alley, listening to a little boy say something quite extraordinary, and then being unable to do his job.
He shot her a look. You can't be sure there's a connection.
She held up a page of the sketchbook for him to see. Oh, I'm pretty sure there's a connection.
The drawing was stark, exacting, possessing a powerful clarity that seemed beyond a young boy. A figure that looked so like Kevin it could have been a self-portrait was standing in what looked to be a high-walled alley. A man who could have been Webb, in complete combat gear, was in full running stride next to Kevin. The boy's hand was extended. What was in the boy's hand had Webb fixated. The device was small, easily secreted in a trouser pocket. The stream of light that shot out from it reached across the page and ended at the margin. It was as though the boy held some sort of futuristic weapon that shot light beams, a la Star Wars or Star Trek.
Actually, it was a device that all people, especially kids, would be familiar with these days. It was a remote control, and this one was sending out a beam of light. It could have been to a TV, stereo, or some other electronic equipment, but Webb knew that it wasn't. He hadn't even seen a TV in Kevin's house, and there was certainly not one in his room. This remote control, Webb felt sure, had activated the laser in the courtyard that in turn had triggered the miniguns when Webb and Charlie team had come thundering into the space. The kid had kick-started it all. And somebody had prepared the boy for exactly what he would see that night, namely men in body armor with guns. For it wasn't like Kevin Westbrook had come back to his house to make this drawing after the fact. Who was that someone? Two cars behind Webb's Mach, Francis Westbrook drove the Lincoln Navigator himself. Without product to sell, a large part of his crew had already jumped ship. Folks didn't let the grass grow under their feet in the drug trade, and the grass always seemed to be greener someplace else. Of course, when you got to the new place, it was just the same old crap. You lived and died by your wits, and the stupid did not survive for very long. Yet for every dealer that was killed, a dozen were ready to take his place. The lure of the drug business was strong, despite its high mortality rate, because people in Francis Westbrook's world weren't exactly loaded down with options. Forget the social scientists with their little charts and graphs. Westbrook could vividly teach the mother of all courses on that subject. He shook his head as his thoughts returned to his dilemma. Peebles was nowhere to be found, and even the once loyal Macy had disappeared. The men he had left were not ones Westbrook really trusted. Thus, he had gone it alone on this mission. He had been watching Jerome's place in the hopes that Kevin might come wandering up. Instead, he had gotten a nice prize in the interim, HRT London and the woman. She was the shrink. He at least had learned that before his men deserted him. He steered with his fingertip, his right hand on the grip of the pistol lying on the front seat. He had watched London and the woman go in and then come out with Jerome. The lady had been carrying Kevin's sketchbooks, and Francis wondered why. Did the books have a clue to the boy's whereabouts? He had personally searched this city high and low looking for his son, threatened people, broken bones, and overinflated egos in the process, shelled out thousands in cash for snitch work, and with all that, nothing. The feds sure as hell didn't have him. They weren't playing games with him, perhaps trying to get Kevin to testify against the father. Of that he was sure. Francis had been real careful on that. Kevin knew nothing about what his old man did, at least not the sort of details that were required on the witness stand. But if he did, Francis would just bite the bullet and take the fall. Above all, he had to do what was best for Kevin. In many ways, he had already led a full, rich life, about as much as someone like him could reasonably expect. But Kevin had a lot more living to do. London was a smart guy. Francis's plan was to follow him and see where that took him. Where he hoped it took him, of course, was to Kevin. Chapter 43. Webb drove Claire home, where she packed some clothes and other things, and then he took her to her car and followed her to a hotel where she checked in. After they'd promised each other to keep in touch with fresh developments, Webb rushed back to East Winds. Romano was at the carriage house. "The Canfields are in the house. I don't know what happened, but something shook them up. White as sheets, both of them." "I know what did it, Paulie," and Webb explained about the videotape. "You know, there was nothing you could do, Webb. I'm just pissed I was overseas at the time. I would have loved to hit those guys." He snapped his fingers. "Oh, before I forget, Ann Lyle called and said she really needed to talk to you."
"How come she didn't call me directly?"
"I talked to her a couple of days ago, just checking in. I gave her the phone number here, just in case we needed a hardline contact." Webb pulled out his phone and while he was dialing Anne, he asked Romano, "So how'd Billy like your vet?"
"Sweet, man, sweet. Said he had an opportunity to buy one a couple of years ago for... Are you ready for this? For $50,000. 50 big ones."
"Better not let Angie find out about that. I see four wheels and a ragtop becoming new furniture and college accounts."
Romano paled. "Shit. I never thought of that. You gotta swear you won't tell her, Webb. You gotta swear."
"Hold on, Polly." Webb spoke into the phone. "Ann, it's Webb. What's up?" Ann's voice was very low.
"There's something going down here. That's why I'm here so late."
Webb tensed. He knew what that meant.
"An op?"
"The guys built a new target in the practice area 2 days ago and have been going over it like crazy. The assaulters have been going through their equipment today 7 ways from Sunday, and the commander's door has been closed all morning, and some of the snipers have already been deployed. You know how it is, Webb."
"Yeah, I know. You have any idea what the target might be?"
Anne's voice dropped even lower.
"A tape from a surveillance camera came in a few days ago. It shows that a truck was parked at the loading dock of an abandoned building near where the shooting occurred. The tape wasn't at the best angle, I understand, but I believe it shows the guns being unloaded from the truck."
Webb nearly tore the phone in half. Bates had kept this from him.
"Who is the truck registered to, Ann?"
"Silas Free. He's one of the founders of the Free Society, Webb."
"Pretty stupid of him to use his real name."
"Son of a bitch. They were hitting the freeze.
How are they getting there?"
"Military aircraft from Andrews to an old Marine Corps airfield near Danville. They're heading out at 0-1200. The trucks have already been sent down via semi."
"What's the assault force?"
"Hotel, golf, X-ray, and whiskey."
"That's it? That's not full strength."
"Echo, Yankee, and Zulu are out of the country on VIP protection detail. There's no Charlie team. And on top of that, one of the hotel assaulters broke his leg during a training exercise. And Romano's with you on special assignment. We're a little thin right now."
"I'm on my way. Don't let the train leave without me."
He looked at Romano.
"Get the guys at the gates to collapse around the house and take over protection detail."
"Where are we going?"
"It's time to bang 'em and hang 'em, Paulie."
While Romano called the perimeter guards, Webb ran outside, popped the trunk of his Mach, and checked what he had. The answer was he had plenty. The life of an HRT operator required that he keep several days' worth of clothes in his trunk, along with a variety of other items essential for when you were called out of the country for a week or a month with virtually no notice. Webb had supplemented this normal allotment with lots of goodies he had taken from the HRT equipment cage and the stash he kept at home, which included a formidable arsenal. Even with his FBI creds, he'd have a tough time explaining this cache to a state trooper on a routine traffic stop. When Romano came back, Webb said,
"Bates kept it from me, the little shit.
They found direct evidence tying the freeze to the hit on Charlie, using the damn tip I gave him. And he wasn't even going to invite us to the party. Probably thinks we'll freak and pop people unnecessarily."
"You know," said Romano, "that really offends my sense of professionalism."
"Well, tell your sense of professionalism to shake a leg. We don't have much time."
"Well, why didn't you say so?" He grabbed Webb's arm. "If speed is what we need, we ain't taking that hunk of junk."
"What the hell are you talking about?"
5 minutes later, the big block vet, loaded down with weaponry, blew through the open gates at East Winds and hit the main strip. It was mostly back roads down to Quantico, but Romano kept the vet on 70 pretty much the whole way, going around curves so fast, Webb felt himself grabbing the edge of his seat and hoping Romano didn't notice. When they got to Interstate 95, Romano smoothly shifted gears and popped the clutch. Webb watched the speedometer swiftly move to triple digits. Romano slid in an 8-track tape, of all things, and revved up the music. The best of Bachman-Turner Overdrive was soon shattering the night air because they were driving with the top down. While Romano drove, Webb checked their guns. Even with the highway lights, it was very dark, but his fingers knew every inch of the things. He looked over at Romano, who was smiling and singing along with BTO as they were taking care of business. The guy was bobbing his head like he was back in high school and banging at a Springsteen concert.
"You got a strange way of preparing yourself for combat, Paulie."
"What, like you and the rubbing you give your pistols for luck?"
Webb looked at him in surprise.
"Rhina told me. He thought it was a hoot."
"I guess nothing sacred," muttered Webb. They cruised into Quantico in record time. They both knew the sentry posted at the east entrance off the Bureau Parkway, and Romano didn't bother to slow down.
"888, Jimbo," he yelled out as he roared by, referring to the crisis page of 3-8s that told HRT members to get the hell to Quantico.
"Go get 'em, guys," yelled back Jimbo.
Romano parked the car. They pulled their gear and hauled it to the admin building. Romano used his security card to open the gate, and they headed to the front door, where a video surveillance camera was watching them. In front of the entrance, 6 trees had been planted in memory of the fallen members of Charlie Team. Inside, they passed Ann Lyle's office. She came to the door, and she and Webb exchanged a glance, but not more than that. Strictly from the rule book, Ann shouldn't have called and told Webb about the assault, and he would never do anything to get her in trouble. But they both knew that what she had done was the right thing to do, rule book be damned. Webb met his commander, Jack Pritchard, in the hallway. The man looked in astonishment at Webb and Romano with all their gear.
"Reporting for duty, sir," said Webb.
"How the hell did you even know about it?" demanded Pritchard.
"I'm still a member of HRT. I can smell these things a mile away."
Pritchard didn't push it, though he did glance in the direction of Ann Lyle's office.
"I want in," said Webb.
"That's impossible," said Pritchard. "You're still on SRB leave, and he pointed at Romano, "got his ass taken off on special assignment that I wasn't even made privy to. Now shove off."
The commander turned on his heel and headed back to the equipment room. Webb and Romano shoved off right after the man. The assaulters and snipers who hadn't already been deployed on the mission were gathered here, going over last-minute details. The snipers were checking to make sure they each had restocked a numbered lot of match-grade ammo. They were updating logbooks, tightening trigger assemblies, and cleaning scopes and barrels. The assaulters were inspecting their own weapons and breaking out their breaching gear, tactical bags, and body armor. The personnel in the logistics cell of HRT were running around, loading gear into the trucks, and trying to remember everything the mini-invasion would need to succeed. They all stopped doing what they were doing when Pritchard and then Webb and Romano barged into their space.
"Come on, Jack," said Webb. "You got teams all over the damn place, and not even counting Paulie, you're short a guy on hotel. You can use the extra hands."
Pritchard whirled around.
"How the hell did you know we were short a guy?"
The HRT chief obviously had had enough of leaks. Webb looked around the room.
"I can count, and I count 5 assaulters on hotel. Add me and Paulie, and you're at full strength."
"You haven't been briefed, you haven't worked the mock target, and you haven't even been training for a while. You're not going."
Webb moved in front of the man and blocked his way. Jack Pritchard was about 5'10", and Webb had him by at least 30 pounds and about 5 years. But Webb knew if it came to a fight that he would be in for one. But he didn't want a fight. Not his own man, anyway.
"Brief us on the way over. Show us the attack points. We've got our own equipment, and all we need are Kevlar, a flight suit, and a helmet. How many of these have Paulie and me done, Jack? Don't treat us like some clueless bastard right out of knots. We don't deserve that."
Pritchard stepped back and stared at Webb for a very long minute. The longer it went on, the more Webb thought Pritchard might actually throw him out of the place.
HRT, like other quasi-military units, frowned on such insubordination.
I tell you what, Webb, I'll leave it up to them.
He pointed at the assaulters. Webb hadn't been expecting that sort of decision. But he stepped forward and looked at each of the hotel and Gulf guys one by one. He had fought side by side with most of them, first as a sniper and then as one of their own, an assaulter. His gaze finally settled on Romano. The men would accept Pauly back without question. But Webb was damaged goods, the guy who had frozen at the worst possible moment, and every man in this room was wondering if he would do it again and cost them their lives. Webb had saved Romano's life during a raid on a Montana militiaman site. Romano had returned the favor a year later during a VIP protection detail in the Middle East when a foot soldier from a fringe rebel group had tried to run their party down with an empty bus he had stolen. The rebel would have succeeded in getting at least Webb, but Romano had pushed Webb out of the way and popped the driver between the eyes with a round from his .45. Yet despite all that and their recent time together, Webb had never really been able to read the man. As he looked around the room, it seemed that the men were looking to Romano to settle the issue. And despite the guy having driven Webb here to take part in the assault, Webb had no clue what he would say now. He watched as Romano put a hand on Webb's shoulder. Looking at his teammates, Romano said, "Webb London can cover my back anytime, any place." And in the Alpha Male Society of HRT, a man like Paul Romano, who was feared even by some of his teammates, saying that was all it took. After they finished suiting up, Pritchard called all the men into the small meeting room. He stood at the front, staring at them, and they stared back. It seemed to Webb that the commander spent more time gazing at him than at any of the others. "It goes without saying," began Pritchard, "that this mission is critical. All our missions are critical. I know that each man here will conduct himself in the utmost professional manner while still doing his job to the best of his ability." Pritchard's tone was stilted. The man looked nervous, and he had done enough dangerous things in his life that Webb had long assumed the man had no nerves. Webb and Romano exchanged glances. This sort of pep talk was a little out of the ordinary. They weren't a bunch of high school kids getting ready to play football. Pritchard's stern demeanor collapsed. "Okay, let me cut the official crap. The folks we're going after tonight are suspected of doing in Charlie Team. You all know that. We hope we're going to hit them by surprise. Short and sweet and no shots fired." He paused and looked up and down the ranks once more. "You know the orders of engagement. This free society has come our way before, down in Richmond. That was Charlie Team, too. And some think that what happened in that courtyard was an act of revenge by the Frees. There are no known hostages. The ground logistics are a little tricky, but we've handled far worse. We fly in, the trucks will be waiting, and we execute." Pritchard was pacing now, and then he stopped. "If you have to take a shot tonight, you do it. If they fire back, I don't have to tell any of you what to do. But don't be stupid about this. The last thing we need is for the media to be screaming tomorrow morning about HRT wiping out guys who don't need to be wiped out. If they were involved in Charlie's getting ripped, let's bag them and let the legal process work its course. Don't, and I repeat, don't fire because you're thinking about what these guys might have done to six men who belong to us. You're better than that. You deserve better than that. And I know you'll come through." He paused once more and seemed to search each of his men's faces, once again lingering the longest, it seemed, on Webb. Pritchard finished with, "Let's hit it." As the men filed out, Webb walked up next to Pritchard. "Jack, I hear where you're coming from. But if you're that concerned about somebody going off the deep end, why have HRT do this hit at all? You said there aren't any hostages, so an FBI SWAT team could handle this with backup from the locals. Why us?
We're still part of the FBI, Webb, although you wouldn't know it from the way some people act around here. Meaning orders from uptown for HRT to do this gig. That's the procedure, and you know that as well as I do.
Because of the circumstances, did you request a pass on this one?
Actually, I did, because I personally don't think we should be doing it. Not this soon after losing our guys. And I agree with you. A SWAT team could go easy enough.
And they turned you down.
Like I said, we're part of the FBI, and I do what I'm told. Now, you wanted in on this. Are you backing out now?
See you at the OK Corral.
A few minutes later, they were on their way to Andrews Air Force Base, ready to go to war. The Bureau, Webb had learned from one of his HRT colleagues, had contemplated executing a search warrant on the Freeze compound, but had decided that they would let HRT secure the place first and then execute the search. The last thing the Bureau wanted was a couple of agents getting killed while trying to serve the search warrant. Besides, video of machine guns used to kill federal agents being unloaded from a truck rented by Silas Free was pretty damning. On the short, bumpy flight down in a military transport jet, Webb went over the 5-paragraph operations order, and he and Romano were filled in on specific details. There would be no negotiation with the Freeze, and no warnings to come out with their hands up. The memories of the school incident in Richmond and the massacre of Charlie Team had precluded those options. Fewer people would die tonight if HRT just hit them without warning. At least, that's what the powers that be had decided, and Webb was perfectly fine with that decision. The fact that there were no known hostages made things easier and also more complicated. Complicated in that Webb was still wondering why an FBI SWAT team hadn't been called in to handle this. He hoped it was a combination of the reputation the Freeze had for being extremely dangerous and well-armed, and the fact that even the good guys were entitled to exact sweet justice some of the time. But something just didn't feel right about this. Intelligence gathered by WFO over the last several months put the Freeze at a compound they had created a decade earlier, about 40 miles west of Danville, Virginia, in a very remote part of the state, with woods on three sides. Snipers from Whiskey and X-Ray had set up surveillance 24 hours before with WFO agents and had been feeding valuable intelligence back ever since. The plans for the target had actually been in the HRT database for a while now. HRT had rebuilt the interior of the school on its back lot and practiced with something more than the unit's usual vigor and determination. While there wasn't an HRT member who would consciously open fire unless he, another team member, or an innocent person was in danger, there wasn't a single HRT operator who wasn't at least partly wishing that the Freeze would try and fight back. Maybe, Webb thought, that group would include Commander Jack Pritchard, too, despite his passionate speech to the contrary. They landed, climbed in their trucks, which had just been offloaded from a special truck transport, and drove to the preliminary staging area and interfaced with the local police and folks from WFO who were spearheading the effort. Webb turned his back and fiddled with some of his gear when he saw Percy Bates appear from one of the Bucars and talk to Pritchard. Webb didn't really need a run-in with Bates right now for a lot of reasons, the main one being he didn't know if he could trust himself not to punch the guy's lights out for not telling him about the assault. Bates was probably just trying to protect Webb, maybe from himself, but Webb would have preferred to make that decision on his own. They drove to the last staging point and received a final set of orders. Now it was time to hit the road to the target. They moved quickly through the darkened rural roads. Hotel Team was in one Suburban and was approaching the Freeze compound from the rear, while Gulf was going in the left side. The topography would require the assault teams to navigate through the dark, dense woods. That wasn't really a problem, since they had night vision optics.
Just before the truck doors popped open, Romano crossed himself. Webb almost said what he had always said to Danny Garcia, that God didn't come around here and that they were on their own, but he didn't. Yet he wished Romano hadn't done the sign of the cross. This was all beginning to seem way too familiar, and for the first time, Webb started to wonder if he was in any shape to participate in the assault. The doors popped open before he could think any more on this, and they poured into the woods and then came to a stop, crouching and surveying the terrain ahead. Through his bone mic, Webb listened as the snipers filled them in on what lay ahead. Webb recognized Ken McCarthy's voice from X-ray. McCarthy's call sign was Sierra 1, meaning he held the sniper's highest observation post. He was probably straddling a thick branch of one of the big oaks that ringed the perimeter around the compound, Webb figured. That would allow him to see the entire area, get a good firing lane, and provide maximum defilade, or position of cover and concealment. The Frees were definitely inside the compound. Most of them lived there, in fact. The snipers had counted at least 10 of them inside. There were 4 buildings constituting the fenced compound. 3 were living quarters, and 1 was a large warehouse-style building where the men held their meetings and did whatever work they did while there, such as making bombs and plotting how to kill innocent people, no doubt, thought Webb. There were often dogs at outposts like this. Canines were always a problem. Not so much a personal danger to HRT members, since even the fiercest dog couldn't bite through Kevlar or withstand a bullet, but they were terrific early warning sentries. Fortunately, thus far at least, there were no dogs here. Maybe some of the Frees were allergic. The weaponry they'd seen were mostly pistols and shotguns, although one young lad of about 17, McCarthy said, was carrying an MP5. There were 2 sentries outside, one in the front and one in the rear, armed with pistols only and bored expressions, McCarthy wryly noted. As was customary with HRT, the sentries were given identification names by the sniper that had first spotted them. The guard in front was named Pale Shack, because he bore a passing resemblance to the big basketball center, but of course was white, since the Frees were definitely not going to have persons of another color around. The one in the rear was christened Game Boy, because McCarthy had noted a Game Boy player sticking out of his front pocket. The snipers had also observed that both sentries carried cell phones that had a walkie-talkie feature. That posed a problem, since they could quickly signal trouble to their confederates inside.